I believe she acted alone, but she will have prepared a place for the baby and created a credible story.
What story? I ask.
Most likely she faked a pregnancy, convincing her friends and family that she was due any day. So she stuffed a pillow up her dress, says Jack. I think she would have been a little more sophisticated than that, says Cyrus. Pregnancy prosthetics can be bought online. Other sites sell fake pregnancy tests and ultrasound pictures.
Why didn't she have her own baby? Asks Jack.
Maybe she can't. IVF is expensive and has a 1 in 4 chance of success. Adoption might also be difficult, depending upon her age and background. In my work, I've come across a number of childless women who have contemplated taking a baby. Some had trouble with relationships, others were delusional or infertile, or so desperate for love that a child had become their holy grail.
Will she hurt Ben? I ask.
Under normal circumstances, no.
What are the other circumstances?
If she's frightened or backed into a corner, or desperate to avoid detection, she might panic. But if we send her the right messages, if we keep her calm, she will love Ben and keep him safe.
Do you really think she's listening? Says Jack. Where's the evidence? The police are treating her like a victim, not a criminal. Everybody's supposed to feel sorry for her. But what about us?
He's right, I say. Treating her like a victim hasn't worked. She isn't a criminal or a victim, says Cyrus. Not in her mind. By now she's convinced that Ben is her baby, and we are the people who want to take him away from her. We are the criminals.
That's ridiculous, I say, my voice shaking. He's our baby.
Of course he is, says Cyrus, and we'll get him back. He takes off his glasses and rubs the bridge of his nose. More than 60 babies have been abducted in Britain over the past 30 years, and all but 4 have been recovered safely. I know that's a very thin numerical base, but I hope you can take comfort from figures like that.
The answer is no. The opposite is true. There is no comfort in being a statistical exception. It's like having a rare disease or being the victim of outrageous misfortune. You keep asking yourself, why me? Why not someone else?
Cyrus looks again at the page on the table. Having studied the abduction, particularly the detailed planning and the confident execution, I'm starting to suspect this woman might have done this before.
Taken a baby? Asks Jack,
either as a trial run or a failed earlier attempt.
When? Where?
I've asked DCS McAteer to go back over the files of past abductions, as well as missing children and security breaches at hospitals and schools. I look at Jack, wondering if he's getting the same message.
There's something else, says Cyrus, choosing his words carefully.
I think we should consider the possibility that Ben was chosen.
What do you mean, chosen?
I ask. There were 18 babies in the maternity ward that night. This woman walked past at least 6 mothers with newborn babies. Why didn't she choose one of them? I'm struggling with the notion.
So you think...
I'm trying to explain the inconsistencies.
Why would she choose Ben?
Asks Jack. She may have seen Meg arriving at the hospital, or she may have recognized you from the TV, or she could have identified you earlier. Did you notice anyone following you in the weeks leading up to the birth? Any strange cars or phone calls? I shake my head, less certain than before. How many other people knew when and where you were having your baby?
I try to think. My mother's group, my yoga instructress, my hairdresser, the girls in the class, Lucy's teacher, the staff from Lachlan's preschool, my doctor knew, of course, my mother.
What about your blog? Jack asks. Cyrus raises his eyes from the page.
What blog?
I write a mummy blog, I explain. It's a hobby, I guess.
What do you write about?
I shrug, feeling embarrassed. About my life, the kids, Jack, but I never use our real names.
She has 6,000 followers, says Jack, trying to be helpful. Did you tell people when you were having your baby?
My heart sinks. I might have mentioned...
Did you give the date?
I nod.
Did you mention the hospital?
Maybe.
Have you corresponded with any of these women?
They comment on my posts or send me messages.
And you reply?
Not all the time. I know what he's thinking. Some of these readers will be pregnant or have young families or might have lost babies.
Any haters or trolls?
He asks. Maybe. Some. Very rarely. Hardly any. I have never posted where I live or mentioned the names of streets or schools.
I know I sound defensive. How do we get all that free stuff? Asks Jack.
Companies know who writes these blogs, I say, and my friends know. I'm digging myself into a hole, but this is not about protecting me. I try to think. Could someone have been stalking me? I rack my brain. A few weeks ago, a BMW followed me through a changing light at Hammersmith. What about that creepy woman who hangs around the pond when I'm feeding the ducks with Lachlan? She's always scratching at her arms and talking to herself. Once I start, I can't stop. There's a homeless man who sleeps in the doorway of the church. He sometimes knocks on people's doors asking for odd jobs. And a man at the library who tries to look up women's skirts when they sit on beanbags to read stories to their children.
Has anyone taken a special interest in your pregnancy? Asks Cyrus.
I don't think so. I know lots of pregnant women. I've been doing prenatal yoga classes at the fitness center, and my blog gets lots of comments from new mums.
Has anyone stood out? They might have been particularly intense or asked a lot of personal questions.
Not really. Jack interrupts. What about the one whose husband is in the Navy? Agatha, I say. She's not intense.
Who's Agatha? Asks Cyrus.
She does my yoga class.
How long have you known her?
A month or so. She works locally.
And she's pregnant.
She had her baby before me.
Cyrus is taking notes. Do you have an address for Agatha?
I have her phone number and an email address. From outside I hear a commotion. Shouts. Scuffling. Annie opens the front door. Reporters are besieging DCS McAteer as he steps from a police car. Chaperoned by his driver and another detective, he pushes his way through the media scrum, ignoring their questions. I meet them in the hallway, which is suddenly very crowded. McAteer glances at Cyrus, nods. No handshake. He addresses me.
A newborn baby has been left outside a church in Little Drayton in Shropshire. It's a baby boy. But we don't know if it's Ben, he says.
I step back, swaying and reaching for the wall.
The baby has been taken to the nearest hospital. I want to stress, we don't know if it's related to this case, but I thought you should hear about this from me and not from the rabble outside.
A question gets stuck in my throat. Jack speaks.
What do we know?
From the initial reports, the baby might only be a few hours old. He's being examined by doctors.
It's Ben, I blurt. It's him.
We don't know that, says McAteer. We may have to do a DNA test.
Please let me see him. I could feed him. I'm still expressing.
McAteer exchanges a glance with Cyrus. They think I'm being irrational. I start to argue. Cyrus cuts me off.
Please, Mrs. Shaughnessy, Megan, don't make this any harder.
McAteer takes out a small plastic test tube.
We want to take a DNA sample. A simple mouth swab.
Of course, says Jack, reaching for the test tube.
No, it should be me,
I blurt, aware of the dangers of DNA and the sins it could reveal.
Mother or father, it makes no difference, says McAteer.
I take the tube from Jack and run the cotton swab around my cheek before dropping it into the tube. McAteer seals the top and tucks it into his inner pocket.
I'll let you know as soon as we have news, he says. In the meantime, PC Hipwell will stay here and handle the media. Until we know more, I recommend that you don't make any public statements.
The detectives leave the house, triggering another barrage of questions.
Annie and Cyrus remain behind. He asks whether Jack or I have ever been to Little Drayton, or if we know anyone who lives there. We shake our heads. Jack turns on the TV. We're watching a female reporter outside the hospital in Stoke, struggling to hold down her hair in the wind. The infant boy, who weighs 7 pounds, was found lying inside a cardboard box left next to the main doors of the hall. Paramedics transported him to Royal Stoke University Hospital, where a spokesman issued a brief update in the last half hour, describing the baby as being dehydrated, but generally in good condition. The discovery has triggered intense speculation that the infant could be Ben Shaughnessy, the newborn baby taken from a London hospital 6 days ago. Police are refusing to comment, but a short time ago, the detective in charge of that investigation visited baby Ben's parents, Jack and Megan Shaughnessy, at their house in London. The footage changes to an image of DCS McAteer and his colleagues walking into our house. The entire scene happened less than 20 minutes ago, and already it's on the news.
"It's Ben," I whisper. "We don't know that," says Jack. "Who else could it be?"
"Babies get abandoned all the time." I shake my head.
"Not all the time."
Agatha. The intercom buzzes. I'm dreaming about Rory's first birthday party. The guests are arriving with presents and balloons. I've made a teddy bear cake and set out plates of mini sausage rolls and finger sandwiches. The buzzer sounds again, and the scene dissolves in my head. I hear voices. Hayden is talking to someone on the intercom. He meets them at the top of the stairs, two police officers. I'm watching through a crack in the bedroom door.
"I'm sorry to disturb you," says the detective. "We were hoping to speak to Agatha Fifel."
"She's sleeping," says Hayden.
"I'm awake," I say, calling from the bedroom. "I need a few minutes."
Listening at the door, I straighten my dress and fix my hair, telling myself to breathe normally and stay calm. Are they here about Nikki or the baby? Does it matter?
"You went too far.
It was an accident."
"You killed him."
"No."
"You pushed him."
"I loved Nikki."
The police officers are sitting at either end of the sofa, one dressed in uniform and the other wearing an ugly blue suit worn shiny at the elbows. They stand politely. The uniformed officer is in his late 20s with short cropped hair and a round face that hides a future double chin. The detective is 2 decades older with a boozer's nose and thinning hair. I offer to make them tea or coffee. They decline. I take the armchair. Hayden perches on the roll of the armrest.
"Can I call you Agatha?" the older one asks.
I nod.
"I'm not sure if you've heard the news," he says. "There was an incident at South Kensington Tube Station the day before yesterday. A man fell under a train."
"How awful."
"We believe you may know the victim," says the detective. "Nicholas David Fifel."
I let out a squeak of alarm, covering my mouth.
"It must be a mistake."
"What makes you say that?"
"I saw Nikki yesterday, or was it the day before? No, yesterday. We had coffee together."
"Where was that?"
"At a restaurant near the V&A.
The two officers exchange a look. The detective speaks.
"Am I right in thinking you were married to Mr. Fifel?"
"That's not true," says Hayden. "He's her uncle." I grab his hand and address the detective.
"We divorced 3 years ago."
Hayden pulls away.
"You didn't tell me you were married."
He makes it sound like an accusation.
"We weren't together long," I explain.
"Huh? But you said he was your uncle."
Hayden is making too much of this, embarrassing me in front of strangers. I knew he'd be the jealous type, which is why I didn't tell him in the first place. The two officers look at each other uncomfortably, neither wanting to be caught up in a domestic dispute. The senior one clears his throat.
"When you had coffee with Mr. Fifel, how did he seem?"
"Fine. Good. He was down in London for a conference."
I blow my nose on a tissue and sniffle.
"How would you describe his state of mind?"
"I'm not sure I understand the question."
"Did he seem upset or depressed about anything?"
"Depressed?
No, not really. He was talking about his wife and stepsons. I think he was a little homesick.
Did he tell you that?
No. I mean, he intimated as much.
Did he mention any marital problems?
Not exactly.
What then?
He said he wasn't living up to expectations. I use my fingers to make the quotation marks.
Whose expectations?
I assumed he meant his wife's.
Money issues?
He's a writer, I reply, as though that should explain everything. The uniformed officer speaks.
So your divorce was amicable?
Absolutely.
And you kept his name?
Yes.
Why was that?
I don't know, really. I couldn't be bothered doing all that paperwork, changing my driver's license, my passport, my credit cards.
Hayden is pacing at the window, pretending to look out, but his eyes are darting from side to side.
Where did you say goodbye?
Asks the detective. My mind reaches back.
On the street, outside the cafe.
And that was the last time you saw Mr. Fifel?
I hesitate, not wanting to be caught out. I replay the scene. My face was hidden. If the cameras had picked me out, they wouldn't be asking these questions.
I thought I might see Nicky again at the station, but he was ahead of me.
What were you doing at the station?
I was catching a train to Earl's Court. Nicky said he was going to Victoria.
Did you see him on the platform?
No. I took the Piccadilly line.
Why didn't you walk to the station together?
Asks the detective. I only realized after Nicky had gone. Hayden interrupts.
So did this guy jump or was he pushed? Why would you think he was pushed?
Asks the older detective, swinging his whole body to study Hayden, who grows nervous at the scrutiny.
No reason, he says, but you seem to be asking a lot of questions.
If the guy topped himself, why bother?
I flinch and glance at the officers apologetically. The detective looks at me.
We have spoken to several eyewitnesses who suggest Mr. Fifel may have been pushed or bumped from behind. The CCTV images also indicate possible contact, which could have been accidental.
Who was it? Asks Hayden.
We haven't managed to identify the individual. We believe that he or she was wearing a long, hooded overcoat.
The detective tilts his head.
Do you own a coat like that, Ms. Fifel?
Miss, I say, correcting him.
Miss Fifel?
I didn't push Nicky.
I asked if you had a hooded overcoat.
What did it look like?
Black, or perhaps navy, with a looping cowl that becomes a hood.
I glance at Hayden, who is waiting for me to say something.
I used to have a coat like that, but I gave it away to charity.
When was that?
Asks the uniformed officer. I pause as though straining to remember.
Weeks ago now, I put it in one of those charity clothing bins.
I can see Hayden's reflection in the glass. He's staring at me.
Well,
says the detective, wiping his hands down the front of his trousers.
I think that covers most of it. If you do remember anything more,
I'll be in touch, I say.
They're almost at the door. The detective turns.
Out of interest, did Mr. Fifel contact you or did you call him?
He called me.
How long had it been since you'd spoken to each other?
Years.
So why did he call?
He'd heard about the baby.
Baby?
I had a baby boy 10 days ago. I point at the cards on the mantelpiece, some from friends and others that I posted to myself.
Congratulations.
Thank you, I say. Nicky and I didn't manage to have children. We tried. I think it's why we broke up in the end, the stress and disappointment.
I see,
says the detective, but I don't like the tone of his voice. I don't know if he does see, or how much he's seen, or if he believes me.
Goodbye, Mr. Cole,
he says to Hayden, who doesn't respond. I stand on the landing and watch them descend the stairs, bracing myself for what's to come. Hayden paces back and forth behind the sofa, tugging at his ear, something he does when he's thinking. Having taken a seat, I keep turning my head to maintain eye contact.
Why did you lie?
You said he was an old friend, an uncle. I thought you might be jealous.
Me? Why?
Men can get funny about that sort of thing.
Is that right? Who told you that? Your other husbands?
There was only one. Please don't be like this.
Why did you divorce?
We couldn't have a baby. Nicky had a low sperm count. We tried everything, but it didn't work out. That's what we talked about over coffee.
Does Jules know you were married?
No. Yes, I might have told her.
So everyone knows except me?
No, not everyone.
What else aren't you telling me?
Nothing.
What about your coat? You told those coppers you gave it to charity when it's right this minute hanging in your wardrobe.
That's not the one I meant.
What?
That's a different coat.
It looks the same.
I like the style. The old one was getting worn at the elbows and it had lost two buttons.
When did you buy a new coat? You barely left the flat.
I bought it online. They delivered it when you were out.
Hayden wants to believe me, but I can see that he's struggling. He hates secrets and doesn't like being surprised. At the same time, he's enjoyed being a father and playing happy families. I can see it in his eyes and hear it in his voice when he talks about Rory.
I put my arms around him from behind and hug him, pressing my head to his back. He turns around and we kiss. I open my eyes and discover that he's watching me. The creature slides between my organs and coils around my heart, slowly tightening.
Stupid, stupid, stupid.
Megan. The baby isn't Ben. According to the hospital, he was barely 6 hours old when abandoned. The mother, all of 16, gave birth in her bedroom and smuggled him outside in her school bag, leaving him on the steps of the hall. Mother and unwanted child have since been reunited. How touching. My first reaction was denial. I said the mother was lying and demanded a DNA test. How ironic. In the same breath, my shoulders shook, and I knew I was being irrational. It's someone else's child, but that doesn't make it fair. She doesn't want a baby. She doesn't deserve one. Annie broke the news to us. My strength disappeared, and I took myself to bed, clutching a box of tissues. Jack came in later and sat beside me. I knew he wanted to talk, but I pretended to be asleep. Call me a coward, but I know how any discussion will end. I will accuse Jack of never wanting Ben in the first place, of suggesting a termination, of wishing for something like this. And he will look at me like a fur seal about to be clubbed and beg me for forgiveness, which I will give him, because I know it's not his fault. But the absolution will be phony, because it doesn't come from the heart. The longer this goes on, the worse it becomes. At first I was swept along by the support and public goodwill, but now that's not enough. My life has stopped. The planet does not turn for me. I keep reminding myself of Annie's words that no news is good news, but is that true? I don't know anymore. In the meantime, I hope for a miracle while fearing that God is punishing me for being unfaithful to Jack or for not believing in him. When it comes to religion, I'm one of those doubters who keeps demanding proof, who is awestruck and horrified by turns at the beauty and the cruelty that believers claim in the name of their God. I try to pray, but I struggle to recall the hymns and psalms from my days at Sunday school. The only prayer I can remember was from our weekly assemblies, when we stood in class groups, promising to love one another, saying that, as many hands build a house, so many hearts make a school. I close my eyes and summon my own words, listening, hoping for an answer. Nothing. God is on another call. We have the media conference this afternoon. DCS McAteer requested we arrive early to rehearse what we're going to say. We leave the house just after 2 o'clock. I'm wearing makeup for the first time in ages, and I've dressed in a pre-pregnancy skirt with the top button undone, hidden beneath the sweater.
The police station is shabbier than I expect. Apart from the computers and printers, it doesn't look very high-tech or cutting-edge or CSI. The incident room is cluttered and noisy, full of functional furniture that must have been fashionable in the 90s. Detectives in plain clothes are answering phones and tapping on keyboards. How is that going to find Ben, I want to ask. They should be knocking on doors and shaking trees. Cyrus Haven is already seated at the table in the conference room, dressed in his familiar loose-fitting jeans and a buttoned-up shirt. Immediately, I relax. I don't know why, but he makes me feel as though I can get through this. McAteer takes a stick of gum from his pocket. Unwrapping the foil, he folds the strip onto his tongue and chews noisily, sucking out the flavor.
I've asked Dr. Haven to run through a new strategy.
Why do we need a new strategy? Asks Jack, who seems to be spoiling for an argument. McAteer pushes back.
Because the current one hasn't worked.
Circumstances have changed, adds Cyrus, whose voice exudes calm. When Ben was first taken, we adopted a strategy of appealing directly to the woman who took him. We wanted to show her the enormity of the anguish she had caused to you, and encourage her to give him up willingly. We have moved past that now. The longer she has had Ben, the stronger the bond between them. If we haven't reached her by now, one of two things must have happened. Either she's stopped listening, or she's decided not to respond.
What you're saying is that she doesn't care, I say.
I'm saying that you don't figure in her calculations. All she cares about is Ben. I feel sick. That's why I want to change the focus of our message. Instead of appealing directly to the abductor, we talk to those around her, friends, family, and neighbors. We give them reasons why they should ask questions. We help them see that whoever has Ben is misguided and has lost sight of what is right and wrong. And if they truly want to help this person, they should get in touch with us. You think someone will turn her in, says Jack, if we give them the right reasons.
Why haven't they done it already?
They could be frightened or confused or unwilling to get involved. We can change that by taking a very soft tone and avoiding confrontation. We must help the public understand that whoever took Ben is not being viewed as a criminal who must be caught and punished. She is a victim. Something dreadful has happened that prompted her into making some terrible decisions. Perhaps she lost a baby, or was denied one. She has suffered enormously, which is why we have to show her compassion and understanding. We must urge others to do the same, and intervene on our behalf and hers. Jack grunts. So it's not enough that we've lost a child. She's the one who deserves sympathy. If we find her, we find Ben, says McAteer, who seems to be tiring of Jack's petulance. Cyrus continues. Right now, the media is controlling the message, finding new people to interview every day, reporting rumors instead of facts. They are setting the agenda, not us. We have to change that. From now on, we speak with one voice and set clearly defined goals. And the first step is to have a single person associated with the message.
Okay, I'm up for that, says McAteer.
No, not you, says Cyrus. You're a police officer. You represent the punitive side of this equation.
Who then?
Cyrus looks at me. No, no, not me. I'm shaking my head, not because I'm shy, but because I'm scared. What if I make a mistake? I could push her over the edge. I've written you a script. All you have to do is read it out.
Why can't Jack do it? He's used to being on camera.
It's more powerful coming from you. Jack touches my arm. You can do this. I can help you. Flash guns strobe and shutters click, and TV lights blast whiteness against my downcast face. It feels more like a show trial than a media conference. The TV cameras are arranged in a crescent shape around the front of a stage that has a long table and chairs. The press photographers are on either side, yelling our names, wanting us to turn this way and that.
I blink into the lights with watery eyes, lowering my head to make sure I don't trip up the stairs. Jack is next to me, yet I have a strange, hollow feeling that I'm alone, a sensation of missing someone who is right beside me. I want to reach out and take his hand, but something stops me. McAteer pulls out a chair. I tuck my dress under my thighs and sit upright, knees together, staring straight ahead, while the flash guns create white dots behind my eyelids. Once the noise has died down, it is my turn. I try to remember what Jack told me, to look directly into the cameras and forget how many people are watching. My first few words are shaky, but they grow more solid as I continue. This has been a very emotional 9 days, and we have been overwhelmed by the messages of support, the letters of sympathy, and the prayers that have been offered by so many people. I pause, looking up from the page. It seems as though Ben has been adopted by the whole country and belongs to all of us, which is enormously gratifying. Saying that, I'm going to speak very personally today, because I don't think anyone can begin to imagine what Ben means to us. We are a strong family, but we're not whole at the moment. We have a little boy and girl at home who haven't met their brother yet. They're heartbroken, and we can't explain to them what has happened. I can't explain it to myself. I know that somebody out there must know where Ben is. Maybe you don't realize, or you're unsure, or you're frightened. You might suspect someone you love, which is why it's so hard to come forward. I understand loyalty and love. I know the strength of families. I promised myself I wouldn't cry, but I can feel the tears hovering at the edges of my eyelids. I steel myself, remembering Dr. Haven's words. The kidnapper might have stopped watching, but her friends and family will hear you. I picture them now. If you do have suspicions, you're not helping anyone by remaining silent. Come forward. Call. Leave a message. At the very least, let us know that Ben is safe. That's all I want. Some sign that he's okay. The last words get stuck in my throat and come out in a whisper. Jack puts his arm around me. I lean my head into his neck and dissolve into his embrace. The reporters begin yelling questions. One shouts loudest.
Why aren't you DNA testing every baby born around that time?
McAteer has taken the microphone.
More than 2,000 babies are born every day in Britain. We couldn't force parents to give us DNA samples, and even if we could, the cost would run to millions of pounds.
Someone else yells,
Have any of the alleged sightings been confirmed?
We continue to follow up hundreds of leads.
Another hand goes up.
Why haven't you released more of the CCTV footage from the hospital?
The footage is of such poor quality that we believe it could hamper the investigation by muddying the waters and making our task even harder.
How?
The only person likely to recognize the kidnapper from the footage is the kidnapper herself. Rather than help anyone identify her, the footage could make her fearful and agitated. We are not here to punish anyone. Whoever took Ben Shaughnessy needs help and support. We can offer that. We can get her treatment. We can provide counseling.
Agatha. Turn the TV off, I say. Hayden looks at me, surprised. Aren't you interested?
No.
Why not? It makes me too sad. It's true, but I can't explain it to Hayden. I know what it's like to lose a baby. I have felt what Meg is feeling. But she has Jack and Lachlan and Lucy. She should be thinking about them. Hayden mutes the sound and picks up the TV guide, flicking through the pages.
So who do you think took him? He asks.
Who?
Baby Ben.
I shrug, wanting to change the subject.
I've changed my mind, he says.
What do you mean?
I thought it was some rich person who wanted a baby, but now I think it's probably some nutter.
What makes you think she's a nutter?
Stands to reason. He says, you said it yourself,
She likely couldn't have her own kid or lost a baby and it sent her a bit gaga.
A lot of women lose babies.
You know what I mean. He props his feet on the coffee table, which I hate. They're making out she needs help. But if someone took our Rory, I'd want to kill her. I'd track her down, get him back, and do it with my bare hands.
You'd strangle her.
Yeah, I'm trained, you know, hand-to-hand combat. He holds up his palms. These are lethal weapons.
You'd kill a defenseless woman.
If she took our baby, yeah. He scratches at his crotch and examines a scab on his elbow. She's not going to get away with it.
Why not?
Someone's going to turn her in. Stands to reason. She comes home with a baby that she can't breastfeed, or who wakes the neighbours with his crying. What happens when the baby gets sick or needs a jab? What happens when he starts school?
That's years from now.
He waves at me dismissively. What about a national insurance number, or a birth certificate, or a driver's license, or if he applies for a passport?
People will have forgotten by then.
You sound like you want her to get away with it.
No, I'm just saying that she might.
Hayden makes a scoffing sound, and I wonder if he's talking like this to goad me or because he suspects. The creature slowly uncoils, slithering through my intestines, turning my bowels to mush.
He knows. He knows. Shh. He knows. He knows.
Who are you shushing? Asks Hayden.
No one.
I start making up a bottle for Rory. Hayden watches as I measure each spoonful of powdered formula and tip it into bottles of boiled water.
I thought you were still expressing. This is just for backup.
Why don't you let him suckle on you?
My nipples are still sore.
When are they going to be better?
I don't know.
That woman who stole the baby, what would she be doing? He asks.
What do you mean?
How would she be feeding baby Ben?
Using baby formula, I suppose.
He knows. He knows.
How do you think she got away with it? He asks.
I don't know. Maybe she faked a pregnancy, convinced everyone that she was having a baby, says Hayden. It's not likely, though, is it? I mean, 9 months of faking it. He picks at the dirt beneath his fingernails. I thought that's why the police came here.
What do you mean?
Those two coppers. I thought they were looking at everyone who'd had a baby in the past 2 weeks.
I had Rory before Ben was taken.
Yeah, you're right, he says, sounding non-committal. He lights a cigarette and cracks open the sitting room window, kneeling on the floor to blow smoke outside. I can still smell it. I want to tell him to go downstairs, but I don't say anything. Instead, I wonder if the police are checking up on me. I haven't registered Rory's birth, but the law gives me a month. He doesn't need a birth certificate, so I can put it off for longer without anyone knowing. You should call that woman, says Hayden, who stubs a cigarette out on the window ledge.
Who?
Baby Ben's mum. You should find out how she's doing.
I don't want to bother her.
But she's your mate. His face lights up.
Fuck!
What? He gets to his feet.
We should call the newspapers.
Why?
You could sell your story.
I don't have a story.
Sure you do. Your best friend has had her baby stolen. They'll love it.
One new mother talking about another, her mate.
The heartbreak. It could be worth a fortune.
I mean, at least 10 grand. Maybe more.
She's not my best friend.
They don't know that.
No.
He's not listening.
You could do TV interviews. What's that show?
I'm not going on TV.
Meg isn't that good a friend.
But you said, we did yoga together.
You've been to her house?
Once. Have you talked to her since it happened?
No.
I sent her a message, saying I was praying for her baby.
I was thinking of sending a card, but I don't know if that's appropriate.
Hayden slumps on the sofa, angry that I won't agree. We could use that money.
We're fine.
He spends the next 15 minutes in a bad mood. Finally, he says, I bet they're making money out of this. They'll be suing the hospital and selling their story to the highest bidder.
Can you imagine? The perfect couple, a TV star and his hot-looking wife, and a stolen kid.
They'll be milking this for all it's worth. They're not so perfect, I say.
What does that mean?
Nothing. Forget it.
Megan. Jack left the house hours ago without giving me a reason. I watched him from the upstairs window as he marched past reporters, ignoring their questions, and got into his car. He did the same thing yesterday, not coming home until after I'd gone to bed.
What were you doing? I asked him this morning.
Walking, he said, making it seem like a stupid question. I know that he's under pressure. With each passing day, he looks more dazed, like a polar bear kept in captivity too long, rocking from side to side. He keeps asking why the police haven't found Ben. He knows I can't answer the question, but he asks it anyway because it improves on the silence between us. We don't have a full-time police officer in the house anymore, but Lisa, Jane, or Annie visit every day, keeping us informed. It has been 2 days since the media conference, and the public response has swamped the police hotline with thousands of calls, including dozens of fresh sightings, none of them confirmed. Amid the tsunami of new information are the time wasters, trolls, psychics, seers, and conspiracy theorists. I closed down my blog today because some of the messages were so toxic. In the meantime, I go through the motions of motherhood. I make supper and turn down beds and kiss foreheads and sing lullabies. I hope someone is doing the same for Ben. Cyrus says the woman who took him is probably childless or has lost a baby or is trying to hold a relationship together. I have known marriages like that. I'm pretty certain that two of my best friends had babies to make their boyfriends commit. Men who were hovering on the threshold. Is that so wrong? Their marriages have lasted. They have more children and mortgages and all the trappings. If I had the courage to ask, I'm sure neither of those women would regret what they did to close the deal. The police call me at 9. A station sergeant at Fulham Police Station tells me Jack has been arrested for assault and trying to take a woman's baby.
Oh, my God, is the woman all right?
She's fine, the sergeant says, but she's insisting that we press charges. I did explain the situation, but couldn't dissuade her.
Where's Jack?
We're holding him in one of the cells.
Do I have to post bail?
That won't be necessary, but someone will have to come and pick him up.
Can you put him in a cab?
I'd feel better if somebody came and collected him.
I hang up and wonder if I should call my parents, but I don't want them knowing about this. Waking Lachlan and Lucy, I put them in their dressing gowns and slippers.
Where are we going?
Asks Lucy. To get Daddy.
Where is he?
He's been talking to the police.
The temperature has fallen, and it's too cold for the reporters and photographers to be standing outside. Most are sitting in cars, occasionally running the engine to stay warm. Moving quickly, I have the kids buckled up in their seats before the assembled media can react.
Is there any news?
One of them shouts as I reach the driver's door.
No news.
Do you think baby Ben is still alive?
I flinch and turn.
That's a horrible thing to say.
He's waiting for an answer. I slide into the driver's seat and shut the door, fumbling for my keys. More reporters are shouting questions. Ignoring them, I pull out and almost hit a TV cameraman who leaps out of the way.
Why did he ask if Ben was alive?
Asks Lucy. He didn't say that.
Could Ben be dead?
No.
Who's dead?
Asks Lachlan.
Nobody.
I put on a storybook recording and open the window a crack, wanting the cold air to help me stay alert. I'm not supposed to be driving so soon after having a cesarean. Bloody Jack. The station sergeant is lanky and slope-shouldered, with scrubbing brush hair. He lets us wait in his office, away from prying eyes, while Jack is brought up from the holding cells. The police have managed to piece together his movements. He started off at the King's Arms on Fulham Road, drinking pints and whiskey chasers. From there he went to Duke on the Green and the White Horse. At some point, he finished up at the Trafalgar on King's Road, where the publican refused to serve him after he abused a barman. Less than a block away,
Jack confronted a woman who was walking her dog and pushing a baby in a pram. She screamed for help. Two men came to her aid. Jack threw a punch, but they wrestled him to the ground. After calling the police, the bystanders told the woman she couldn't leave until she verified her story, which made her even more upset. "Where is she now?" I asked the sergeant.
"We sent her home."
"I want to apologize to her."
"Maybe it's best if you leave her alone."
Jack shuffles past the door, escorted by two constables. He has buttons missing from his shirt and a graze on his forehead that is weeping blood. I don't know what the stain is on his trousers. I hope it's not urine. He doesn't acknowledge us as he signs for his wallet and mobile phone. Lucy and Lachlan are quiet as we walk to the car. Neither of them takes Jack's hand, as though sensing that he's wounded. I want to say something. I want to berate him for his miserable self-absorption and his self-pitying macho bullshit. At the same time, I picture him walking the streets, lost in his own madness. We drive home in silence. Jack tucks in his shirt and combs his hair before we face the firing squad of cameras outside the house. Once inside, he goes upstairs and I hear the shower running. Meanwhile, I put the children to bed and make myself a hot chocolate. I take it to the front room, curling my legs beneath me on the sofa, nursing the mug. I hear the stairs creaking. Jack looks for me in the kitchen and the laundry, and eventually finds me sitting in the dark.
"What are you doing?"
"Thinking." He sits on the floor and leans his head against my thigh. My hand hovers above his head, but I cannot bring myself to stroke his hair.
"You have to forgive me, Megs," he whispers.
"There's nothing to forgive you for."
He sits up. "Stop. Stop, please. You're breaking my heart. Look at me."
"I can't."
"I know you blame me."
"I don't blame you."
"Yes, you do."
He lets out a muffled sob.
"You think I didn't want another baby. And you think this was my fault. But it's not fair."
"I know."
"I miss him too."
"Yes." I reach out and push back his fringe, running my fingers through his wet hair. His body shudders. "I know it's not fair, but I don't know who else to blame," I say.
"I can't live like this, Megs. You can't keep pushing me away."
"I'm sorry."
"I want us to go back to the way we were."
"So do I."
His eyes are shining. "I keep wondering what we did to deserve this."
"Nobody deserves this."
"It's me," he says. "I have a bad smell about me. Even Simon isn't talking to me."
Every muscle tightens. "When did you see Simon?"
"I went round to his place today. He accused me of wallowing in self-pity. I told him he had no idea what it was like to be a father and to have a child go missing."
"What did he say?"
"He said I was talking out of my arse, and he knew exactly how it felt. He said if I took better care of things at home, this might not have happened." I asked him what he meant, and he said, "Ask Megs."
"Me?"
"Yeah."
"I don't know what he's talking about."
"Did something happen? I mean, you and Simon used to get on, but now you don't want him in the house. Did he say something or do something? Did he touch you?"
"We've been through this."
"Because if he did, he didn't touch me."
Jack sighs and presses his fingertips to the cut on his forehead.
"I'm sorry about today."
"You should go to bed."
"I can't sleep."
"Take one of my pills."
He kisses me on the cheek, and I hear him climb the stairs. 20 minutes later, I follow him and find him snoring gently in our bed.
I check that Lucy and Lachlan are also asleep before pulling on a warm jumper and lacing my trainers. Rugged up against the cold, I open the French doors and cross the back garden by torchlight. Dew glistens on the grass ahead of me. Reaching the shed, I use the trellis to pull myself up onto the wall and swing my legs over the side, dropping down into a pile of dead leaves and lawn clippings. I'm not supposed to be climbing or lifting anything heavy until my stitches have healed. The torch throws shadows on a fallen tree, and I notice a small clearing with signs of previous occupation. There are empty cans of soft drink and chocolate wrappers. Maybe this is a teenage love nest, uncomfortable but well hidden. I glance back at the darkened house. Anyone sitting on the log could look across our garden to the kitchen and dining areas and see shadows against the curtains upstairs. Turning away, I negotiate an overgrown path through blackberry bushes until I reach the railway tracks and turn east towards Barnes Station. At the nearest level crossing, I follow the footpath, hearing the rattle of distant trains. On the South Circular, I hail a passing cab and give the driver Simon's address. Twice on the journey, I almost ask him to turn back. I'm angry, which is not a good start. We're here. The lights are on. I ring the doorbell and listen for the footsteps. Gina answers, Simon's girlfriend. I didn't expect...
Megs! What are you doing here?
I need to speak to Simon.
Of course. Come in. Your hands are freezing.
She takes my coat and yells up the stairs for Simon. The house is overheated and smells of curry.
Do you want a glass of wine?
Asks Gina. The bottle's open. Or a cup of tea? No.
Have you eaten?
I'm fine. I'm so sorry about everything. I wanted to call you, but I figured you were probably overwhelmed with calls and messages. I really need to speak to Simon.
Oh, right, of course.
She yells for him again. Simon appears on the stairs, dressed in baggy jeans and a sweatshirt.
Look who it is, says Gina.
I need to talk to him alone, I say. Gina's smile fades.
Of course, I'll just pop upstairs.
She and Simon exchange a glance as they pass each other. Remaining in the hallway, I look up the stairs and make sure she's gone. Simon follows me into the kitchen.
What did you say to Jack?
I ask. Nothing.
He knows something happened between us.
He knows shit.
I told you to leave us alone.
Simon matches my anger.
Is that why you sent the police around here, asking me questions?
What?
Two detectives came to see me. They wanted to know where I was when Ben was stolen. They asked me about my relationship with you. The word blackmail was mentioned.
Did you tell them anything?
No. What did you say about me?
Nothing.
Bullshit.
I was angry. Something slipped out. I told them to forget what I said.
Clearly they didn't get your instructions, he says sarcastically. Thanks to you, I'm a suspect. They know about my priors, the drug possession and dealing. Gina has started asking questions. If any of this gets back to the network, I'll lose my job.
It was a mistake. I'm sorry.
That makes me feel much better.
You promised not to tell Jack.
That was before you dumped me in the shit. Now all bets are off.
You can't do that.
Why not? You don't care about me. I think Jack deserves to know who he married.
No. Please. I'll do the DNA test as soon as we find Ben.
Even as I utter the words, I want to take them back, but it's too late. Simon cocks his head, looking at me dubiously.
What if he's mine?
I'll tell Jack, but if the test shows that you're not the father, I want you to leave us alone. This stops once and for all. Is that agreed?
Simon nods, no longer jacked up and tense. His voice softens.
I'm sorry I accused you of arranging the kidnapping.
I don't want to forgive him. I want to be home in bed with Jack.
Simon moves closer. Is there any news?
No.
What can I do to help?
Nothing.
My body is shaking. Simon puts his arms around me, and for the briefest moment I sink against him, accepting his embrace, enjoying the physical contact. I push him away, hating myself, hating him.
Remember what I said.
Agatha. Rory had a difficult night. He screamed for hours and wouldn't feed. I tried everything. I rocked, jiggled, soothed and patted his back. I carried him in a sling, held him against my heart and walked him up and down stairs. I tried white noise, the dishwasher, washing machine, running water, music videos and the radio. He finally fell asleep at 3 a.m., curled up on my chest on the sofa. I weighed him again this morning,
stepping on and off the bathroom scales and calculating the difference between my weight when I hold him and when I don't. As far as I can tell, he's not growing. Failure to thrive is how they describe it on the internet. So far I've tried 3 different types of formula, but Rory won't take more than 30 mils at a sitting, which he sometimes throws up. He has to start growing soon. He can't be like the others. My dearest babies have all died young. I tell myself there is a purity in that, because only the young are completely innocent. My babies didn't have time to grow up and become adults, to be disappointed or disappoint others. They will always shine brightly and be forever good. Emily was the last one. I lost her 3 years ago. Nicky and I were separated but not yet divorced. I went to Brighton for a week, hoping to find companionship among the summer crowds, but I found no comfort. I exhaled loneliness. It followed me around like a rain cloud or a smell. On my last night, a Saturday, the pubs were full of drunken revellers listening to doof-doof music and smokers spilling onto the pavements. I bought a soft drink and sat on a bench seat on the pier, watching courting couples snog in the shadows or paddle at the water's edge. It had been a hot day and everybody seemed to be waiting for the mercury to fall. I contemplated catching a late train back to London rather than spending another night in my cheap hotel. A young mother passed by, pushing a pram. I don't know what made me follow her home. I didn't plan to steal her baby. I only wanted to look. The woman lived in a garden flat on a quiet street, with an alleyway at the back, and a rear garage, with a sign saying, "Please keep access clear." A small, spiral staircase climbed to the back door. I waited, and watched until the lights went off. A net curtain billowed from a window that had been hinged open to catch the breeze. I reached inside, unhooked the latch, and lifted the window high enough to crawl through. The baby girl was sleeping in a cot. She looked to be about 3 months old. A baby monitor blinked above her head. I turned it off. The red light died. I picked her up and put her in a pillowcase, and carried her out the window like a burglar stealing silverware from a country house. By the time anyone knew Emily was missing, I was back in London. Nicky had moved out of the house, and we had plans to sell, but in the meantime, I had the place to myself. Emily lived for 12 days. It was my fault. She fell asleep while I was feeding her, and I put her straight into her crib, laying her on her back, when I should have kept her upright on my shoulder. If I'd winded her properly, she wouldn't have vomited and aspirated milk into her lungs. I woke at 5 and found her. She wasn't breathing. Her skin was blue. The vomit had dried on her cheek and on the back of her head. I washed her little body and wrapped it in a sheet and took it to my special place. I laid her to rest alongside Chloe and Lizzie, the ones who never grew up, forever innocent and untainted. Set free. It's still early when I put Rory in his pram and push him through the streets, hoping the fresh air might make him hungry. I catch a bus to Hammersmith and another along Kensington High Street as far as the tube station. I have to wait until 9:30 before a young librarian opens the doors of Kensington Central Library. By then, the queue consists mainly of homeless people who are looking for somewhere warm to spend a few hours.
"If you fall asleep, I'm kicking you out," says the librarian. "This is a library, not a shelter."
Sitting at a computer, I create a username and password before beginning a search. Rory watches me from his pram. Periodically, I pause and stroke his forehead, explaining what I'm doing. I type in a search for breast milk and come across dozens of classified ads. "Healthy mother ready to sell extra milk, ASAP. Breast milk for sale, excess amounts, no drugs or alcohol. High quality breast milk, London SW1, organic diet only." At the same time, there are government warnings about sourcing breast milk from the internet, saying it could be tainted or diseased. I wonder if they'd ask for identification. Would they care? I contemplate sending an email, but wonder if the police might be monitoring sites like these, looking for me. I can't take the risk. Deleting the search,
I clear the history directory and take Rory across the road to the pharmacy, where I look at treatments for colic and brands of baby formula that I haven't yet tried. Hayden is waiting for me when I get home. Rory has fallen asleep. I left the